Thank you. Hello, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the first annual report workgroup meeting for the fiscal year 2026 cycle. I'm Tara Porter with ONC, and I will be serving as the designated federal officer for today's meeting. I want to note that all workgroup meetings are open to the public, and public feedback is welcomed. Members of the public can type comments in the Zoom chat feature throughout the meeting or make verbal comments during the public comment period that is scheduled toward the end of today's agenda. You could go to the next slide, please. Today's agenda will begin with a quick roll call to see who is on the line with us today, and then I will transition to the co-chairs to provide a few opening remarks before shifting to a discussion of the work group plans, as well as a discussion of draft topics for the high-tech annual report for fiscal year 2026. We will then shift to a public comment portion before discussing next steps and adjourning today's meeting. Next slide, please. We'll now begin with a roll call of the work group members. When I call your name, if you could just please indicate that you are present, we will start with our co-chairs. Eliel Oliveira.
Good afternoon, I'm here,
Good
present.
afternoon. Shyla Blend.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Hans Bautendijk. Michael Chang.
Good afternoon, here, and I'm going to turn my camera off now.
Okay, good afternoon. Steve Eichner.
Good afternoon, present.
Hannah Galvin. Bryant Thomas Karras, Anna McAllister.
Hi there, I'm here.
Hi, good afternoon. Kikalamo Oshun-Kenton.
Feel free to call me Dio Shikantan. I'm here. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, thank you. Rochelle Prosser. Mark Sendak. Naresh Sundar
Good afternoon. I'm here.
Rajan. Good afternoon. All right, thank you. I will now turn it over to Eliel and Shyla for their opening remarks.
Well, thank you, Tara, and thank you everyone for joining today. It's great to see this group is starting again in full force. We're going to go over a few things today, and there's quite a bit of work ahead. If you have been on the annual reporting work group, we do quite a bit here. So thank you for your time and for providing us the support that we need. Shala?
Yes, thank you, everybody. It's exciting to be back against our after our hiatus to, continue on with this important work. I agree with Eliel. We're very excited, and we're excited about, our focus areas for this year, and we look forward to the fruitful discussion in the coming months and as we put together this annual report. Believe this was mine. So we're going to go over a few slides here, reviewing, the work group and a few things about what our charge exactly is, to refresh everybody's memory. So as you can see, the overarching charge will be to inform, contribute, and review the draft and final versions of the high-tech annual report, which are going to be submitted to the Secretary of Health and Human Services and Congress each fiscal year. And as a part of that, our work group helps track the ongoing high-tech progress. The specific charges with that is to provide feedback on the context of the report as required by the 21st Century Cures Act. This includes the following: analysis of high-tech progress related to the priority target areas outlined in CURES, assessment of health IT infrastructure and advancements for the priority target areas, which we'll be talking about a little bit later, analysis of existing gaps in policies and resources for the priority target areas, and ideas for potential high-tech activities to address the identified gaps. Next slide, please. These are our group priority target areas that were in the 21st Century Cures Act. As you can see, a main focus is interoperability, where the goal of that is achieving a health information technology infrastructure that allows for the electronic access, exchange, and use of health information. Secondarily, we have privacy and security, which is the promotion and protection and privacy and security of health information and health IT. And finally, we have patient access to information, which is the facilitation of secure access by an individual and their caregiver to such individuals' protected health information. Next slide.
Thank you, Shaila. Let me go over a little bit the work plan that we have for the year. So if we can go to the next slide, please. So we have a busy timeline here, as you can see. Usually it's very common for this work group if you have been here before. But we did kick off to validate the topics, as you remember. And we gonna update the status on the annual report by next month. Discuss the priority target areas in July and August, and then have a discussion, and review the draft annual report by August, where we then, with that draft report, we can present that report to ONC to receive feedback. To the rest of the high tech, and finalize the draft report that in October, aiming for a vote in early November so that we can then submit the report to Congress and to the Secretary. That's the timeline we have at this point. We can answer questions in a bit, but if we can go to the next slide, this is the format or the outline for the report. If you're not familiar with it, we're going to have a forward letter from the chairs, the co-chairs. And then we have talk a little bit about the outline, and they would see high tech support team here. Excel would help us putting that together, including Tara and her team. We will talk about the 2026 progress in the priority target areas in the Cures Act, the federal activities across the target areas. And then we'll have the specific content for the year on the annual report work group. So we basically go over the gaps and recommendations across the priority targets. So if you have been in the group before, that's what's going to happen in the coming calls. We're going to talk about the gaps and recommendations for, in this case, interoperability, privacy and security, and patient access. And then to close the report, we have an appendix with the objectives and benchmarks and acknowledgement for the group. And that is also done by the high tech support team, the ONC support team. Next. I'll pass it on to you, Chyla. I think we're going to open the report and talk a little bit about the in plain language, which we have. How the report's going to be organized this year. We are trying to keep it, and I think if you saw last year, this is pretty much aligned with the last, is less text intensive, more graphical and visual, and utilizing plain language. In some cases in the last year, we even used some use cases to demonstrate the situations that the report was conveying. With that, we're going to go and jump to the topic areas right now, and the specific drafted topics that we have. I'll pass it on to you back, Chyla, for us to review that.
Okay. Next slide, please. So, referring back, do we have the list of the annual report topics? We can pull up the draft list.
Yes, we're pulling it up.
Okay, so as you can see here, these are our draft annual report topics list. On the left side, you can see the three main topics are the priority target areas that I had discussed earlier. And on the right, kind of the subtopics going through. So with this, and Tara can keep me in line if not, I think we wanted to go through and look at the subtopics and verify that these are our focus areas and that we don't have any additional areas that we need to add, correct?
Yeah, so just to summarize, so as Shiloh mentioned, the priority target areas is what the themes that are mentioned in the Cures Act that the report is framed by. So this topic list is just really a draft that we proposed kind of based on some prior conversations to have you all start discussing. You don't need to keep all topics on this list, and you can certainly feel free to edit what is here as well as propose different topics. And if you've reviewed prior reports, once we validate this topic list, the subsequent meetings will be kind of doing deeper dives within these topics and discussing the gaps and challenges surrounding these topics, and then coming up with opportunities and recommendations to advance each of these topics. Hopefully that helps with framing the discussion.
Yes, thank you very much, Tara. It was very helpful. So to start off, let's talk a little bit on interoperability. The t suggested topics that were brought on were advantage, and I know some of these we discussed on a pass as we were setting up the meeting, advancing image operability, lab interoperability, pharmacy interoperability, and payer interoperability, improving public health data exchange, improving data quality standardization, improving data sharing for research, reducing administrative burden, and use of AI to support access, exchange, or use of electronic health information. I see we have a hand up by Hans.
Hello, Sheila. Thank you. And again, apologies for joining a little bit later. Just a quick question on this, and it's a clarifying question. The topics of public health and research are separated out as improving, and the first four are advancing and interoperability topics. So I'm just trying to figure out, is there an intentional difference in what we're trying to achieve, or are we just generally for the six topics looking at what it would take to advance or improve/improve interoperability? The other ones, I understand why they are separated out, but those ones I'm not sure whether there was an intention behind separating them.
I'll look to Tara. I don't know that there was an intention. I think these were suggested topics to do deeper dives in. Obviously, there's going to be some overlap, I believe. But Tara, you're welcome to jump on if anybody from your team has additional feedback on that.
Sure. Yeah, I don't think it was an intentional separation. You could certainly say advance public health, interoperability, and data exchange, or parse them out any way that you might want to frame it differently than what is proposed there.
Thank you. That helps clarify. I was trying to figure out whether there was something different about them.
Yeah. So if we do have that suggestion, we can definitely do that.
It seems like that we want to advance, improve on all six, and whatever it might be for each of the topics, whatever the overlap might be.
Yeah, so maybe take that down as a note. Advance and improve might be a good suggestion to add. Steve Eichner.
Thank you. Yes, I was the same question as Hans for the public health reporting or data exchange as well. I did have a couple of other questions. One, looking at in the advanced category, we currently have one content topic listed, but the rest are really more along provider types. And that's kind of an important distinction that images could be cross-cutting and affect many different types of providers or other entities involved in exchanging information. However, the others listed are more along the lines of provider types. And I know things that are of interest across the board are things like access to laboratory results across multiple provider types or multiple user types. The same thing for pharmacy information. So we might want to consider that as how we're describing what we're advancing. The other missing element here, I think, is looking at patient applications or patient resources and tools looking at interoperability. It may not be just about patients accessing information in a provider portal or something, but how are we improving interoperability between provider managed systems and patient systems or patient access systems, getting to a point where a patient can have all of their data consolidated or accessible in a single portal and not having to go multiple places to get all the information about them.
Thank you. That is very helpful suggestion, Steve. Right.
And
Dio.
hi, thank you, Shyla. I just have a question. It's more logistical, really, in truth, in regards to looking at these topics. Are we limited to, should we cut it down to a set number of topics as we're looking to identify these priority target areas? Are we limited, or it's completely up to us how many topics we decide to delve into?
I believe it is up to us. Tara can jump in. We're verifying the list and adding any additional ones. And as she said, this is what they're going to use to bring in like subject matter or focus our future discussions as we plan out the next coming months. And I would think if we have more, it limits a little bit our time on each topic, but Tara or somebody can jump in if you have any additional thoughts.
Yeah, great questions. And no, this list isn't limited. It can be as long as you'd like or as short as you'd like, but just I guess keep in mind the longer the list, obviously it might be a little bit harder to have robust conversations about each. So you might want to consider coming up with some sort of number of what might be feasible to make sure that you're able to do a deep dive in those topics and really come up with strong recommendations. But no, you're not limited, so you can choose as many topics as you would like to dive into with the report.
Thank you.
Eliel, did you have something to say?
Yeah, I can't wait, Shyla, for the other ones that are in line. I feel that there is a couple of great comments here, but I'll wait for my turn. Thank
Michael.
you. Tara, I have a comment about interoperability and one about privacy, but maybe I'll talk about interoperability for right now because it seems to be what we're focused on. I feel like one common thread to all these, I don't know enough about each of them to really know where we are compared to where we want to be for each of these bullet points. But I feel like one common thread is what is the combination of carrots and sticks that ONC could or should be using to drive the community toward interoperability in each of these areas? And I just hope that can be something that cross-cuts all of these. Are there things that we could be doing, maybe with other agencies, other parts of government to push the community forward?
Great comments. Thank you, Michael. I'm going to go home to Anna next, but just quick, we do have some comments in the comment chat. There was a comment regarding the idea of changing it to lab tests orders, enabling sharing across all relevant parties. So talking about that for pharmacy and payer, and also potential value with describing the content areas and then user creation or user categories and how the content areas apply to each user category. So this is a great discussion, thinking about how best that we format this and the most efficient way of going forward. Anna.
Myself off of mute. And so there, I have a number of things I'd like to bring up as potential topics that I think need to be pursued. I was going to bring up some of these under the patient access to information, but I want to concur with Ike's statement about individual access. And one of the things that has become increasingly apparent as somebody who's, a patient, works as a consultant with different companies. We're trying to use IaaS and is embedded deeply in the CMS HealthTech ecosystem, is that IaaS is not working. And we need to figure out why IAS is not working. Everybody's focused on patient matching. I think that's part of it. The reality is we don't really have any benchmarks. We don't really have any metrics around what the specific roadblocks are. But we're pretending that this is an exchange purpose that exists. And then we're just sort of like waiting for fairy dust to happen to make it work. And the reality is it's just not working, which is one of the reasons that a lot of different apps and tools are trying to put everything through the treatment exchange purpose. I also believe very strongly we need to create a lane for research as an exchange purpose and define exactly what that means. I've voiced that on high tech meetings over the past couple of years. But it become more and more apparent to me that IAS is a lovely thing that was written into the TEFCA process, but it's not something that has been taken seriously in terms of implementation. And we need to find a way to make it work, because right now providers are just not allowing apps to have access to the data.
Thank you, Anna. Great comments. Eliel, we'll move to you.
Yeah, thanks, Anna. I totally agree on the matching and record linkage process, which I think, yes, the ILS is a great new advancement for us to be able to, identify someone and then, which I think is well developed, but the process of actually linking someone to many different types of data sources is tricky. And I say that coming from a health information exchange that uses master-patient index technologies to match, and it's not something that we rely, 100% of the time. We have to have high levels of controls to be able to make sure that the matches are accurate, right? So, I know CMS released a guide on how to do that linkage and matching. But I agree with Anna. That's something that we should probably have some definition. And to be honest, I think you all know that we had a prohibition for a long time in creating a national patient ID. So we don't have one, but now that prohibition has been lifted, it didn't create anything, but I think it's maybe part of our group here to discuss what do we need then so that we are not, having this challenge of matching records forever and ever.
So has
So
the prohibition been lifted? I guess I missed that one.
was a few years back. But it didn't provide any solutions. It just the prohibition doesn't exist anymore. Now that was just a comment back to you, and I think I want to highlight also a comment from Steve Eichner related to different types of providers, right? I know we are, simplifying the requirements for certification, which I think is great. But at the same time, so two things that come out of that, right? One is the types of provider. Maybe we want to be more specific about the types of providers that we want to require, certification. Because as you guys know, we only ha have hospitals and primary care providers, under the meaningful use and many other types of EHR vendors that are used by other types of providers do not fall under that. And it's very hard to then integrate. Many of them do their work well, but I think it might be important to highlight that, for instance, behavioral health, post-acute care providers, and other types similarly do not necessarily have EHR vendors that can interoperate as we would want them to, like the other, hospitals and primary care providers. So I think maybe we want to, in another discussion, be that specific. And finally, I think another point here that I think we talk quite a bit on the CMS side that I think for privacy and security might be important, and which also I think in a new revisions of the our HDI rules that it's logging, which I think we need some national standard to define how logs are created by systems, electronic systems, and how can they can be mined so that we can find out who uses what and when. And I think that could fall under the privacy and security aspect. I'll stop there. And I think, Hans, you have your hands up.
Yeah, I want to respond a little bit further or add to the conversation around IaaS provider matching, etc. I think it would be a good topic on the interoperability to have that perspective that cuts across all the interoperability, particularly where the party involved is the consumer, the patient, the caregivers, and what is still needed to make that a seamless experience. So I think that would be a good topic to add and contemplate that, where some of the considerations are consistency, whether it's CMS, TEFCA, HIEs, otherwise, point to points. How can that all work in a consistent fashion? Because not everything will be immediately connected in the same place in the same manner, but the approach should be the same. So I think that would be helpful to discuss and recognize the roles of identity management. All the way through matching, the ability to validate whether the information that was received is indeed accurate per the source. So there are a number of things that that can be put in there. Whether it sits under interoperability or privacy security, they all are going to be dependent on that and patient access. It's all going to sit around that, but we need to look at across the board. As far as that, I had the same reaction as Anna, is that this the prohibition lifted? I believe that it was reduced in that some money can be spent on research, but not an actual implementation of a singular identifier. But that will be interesting as to what that will be. But either way, identity management cannot live separate from matching and vice versa. So it would be a great topic to include here explicitly.
We'll do one more comment here, Ike.
I think in addition to access or access control or identity management, we really need to think about it in terms of access control as we look at the potential for multiple people affiliated with a particular patient in having access in different ways to data, whether you're looking at a parent of a child or looking at an adult providing support services for their parent. What does that mean as we're looking at expanded access to data? Think about it. My mother's in her 80s and was in town for the last couple of days, but it made me recognize that I need to be more engaged in some of the care that she's getting where she lives 1,000 miles from here. How do I get access, maintain access to appropriately to some of her data without creating an additional burden on her or her care providers? So I think that part of that identity management needs to be access control and access management to patients and their caregivers. Might be a way of looking at it or framing it, or patients and their family.
Thank you. Okay, the team will take this back feedback, and we do have another meeting where we'll discuss more with the updated feedback. But in the interest of time, I'm going to move on to the privacy and security portion. So moving down to there, as you can see under, sorry, the privacy and security priority target area, the three topics we currently have are improving transparency and responsible secondary uses of health data, to secondarily improve privacy consent and patient control of health data, and finally, the governance of AI and emerging technologies. So, do we have any feedback from the group or any additional thoughts for additional comments, Ike?
Yeah, I think it's important that we recognize that order becomes really relevant here, as we just were talking about access control and access to limits or control of data. I think it's really important to discuss patient control of data before you start talking about increased transparency and responsible secondary uses of data. Really is tied at the hip, I think, is to who's controlling the release of data for what circumstance.
So what you could think for like the t first topic on there should be patient control of data, and then like go to the following.
Or broader control of data,
Okay.
because it's great to provide increased transparency and secondary uses, but all those uses and things should be managed in the context of what the patients want their data to be used for, because it really is their data, and that should be part of the framing conversation.
We have noted that. Thank you. Any other thoughts on privacy and security, Anna?
Again, I just want to concur with Ike. This was on my list of things to bring up. I mean, we are now at a point where you can do much more granular, where we do have the technological capabilities to do much more granular levels of consent, and transparency about who actually does have access to providing transparency to patients, but actually who is accessing their data and how that data is being used. Whether it's identifiable data or it's de-identified data, like we give a lot of latitude to the data holders under HIPAA to de-identify the data. And once it's de-identified, you can do whatever you want. And the reality is it's never really de-identified. With tokenizations, it's super easy to knit it back together and create an incredibly impressive dossier of health and consumer data, tracking data. That, the only people that can't get access to those dossiers are the patients. Anyway, so I think the fallacy that computable consent through technical means at a more granular level, that we've moved beyond that as a sticking point. I'm not saying it's easy, but I'm saying it's doable and it needs to be prioritized. Secondly, one of the things that's really come to my attention that I've been focusing on lately within the context of privacy and consent, a couple of things. One is the consent that patients sign with providers is a legal document meant to protect providers. It is not real consent for patients. It's not presented in a way that you're actually able to read it and cohere it, and before you sign it, it's given to you as you're like signing up for an appointment, and maybe you're running late, or the doctor just needs to get you in. Like you just kind of sign everything so that you can make it to the appointment. I've experienced this recently, and then we're again through the CMS health tech ecosystem. There are all these discussions about how patients can't trust these apps to be able to access their data because they don't know what's going to do with it. They have to be driven back through the provider portal in some way, shape, or form to actually give more granular consent through the provider. Like the reality is the patients are never really given any kind of trustworthy consent processes with their providers. And like that's something that I feel like we need to provide some leadership on and say, like, enough already with the legal CYA. You're dealing with you say you're concerned about patient privacy and security. Give us some evidence that you actually are, because right now I'm not seeing a lot of it. And
And I
then,
think we'll go ahead.
well,
Go ahead.
third, just the private pet peeve, and just based off of very recent personal experience, I go to MedStar, and a lot of my providers at MedStar. I have a lot of data there. I was notified, I don't know, like a month ago, that there was a data breach in October that included my social security number, date of birth, phone number, home address, and my medical information. And all of that is now on the dark web. I actually already knew that because I have credit monitoring service that have been telling me that since October. So it waits, what? 4 months, 5, 6 months, whatever, before I hear anything from the provider whatsoever. And in response to their response to it is to give me free credit monitoring services. Like that's going to do anything. I'm already getting credit monitoring services who are informing me of how completely inadequate their notification is. So like we have to come up with far more serious penalties for providers when they get hacks and when it's released into the dark web, because it's just this whole like we're going to provide you with free credit monitoring services is absurd, and it's insulting. And like when you couple that with like concerns about providers want to protect patients from other people having access to their data discussions, it's just there's just so much kabuki theater happening. It's ridiculous. Anyway, I'll stop.
Thank you, Anna. Very, very important details, and I'm sure we will be delving into them further as we do discuss that improving privacy, consent, and control. Michael.
Tara, I think my comment is very similar in spirit to Anna's and Ike's, which is that I think a lot of health data that are being used right now in the real world are actually not consented at all because they are de-identified. And they're de-identified, legally and used for whatever they're used for, treatment, payment, operations, research, administrative stuff. And I think that that's something that is confusing for the communities that I work with, because people are always wondering, well, is creating this data set okay? And sometimes different institutions have different decisions about whether it's okay or not when presented with the exact same data. Like, is this thing de-identified, or not? And I think that's a real barrier, right now. Like, everything that's happening right now is all completely legal, but it's just different, and everyone's interpreting the rules differently about is it okay to build this data set. And so I think that some type of I mean, it would be really tough to get some guidance to the community about what are the rules for what constitutes de-identified data in 2026, and is patient consent required for doing, for using a piece of data in 2026? And last thing I'll mention is I was literally just in a meeting about US CDI Plus with some folks from the ONC US CDI team, that this topic came up. And so I just, that may be an avenue for collaboration, within different, sectors of HHS.
All right, thank you. I know we're going to start getting low on time here. Hans.
Thank you. Yeah, on the topic of privacy and security, and particularly privacy and consent, I really appreciate that the topic is on the list. And what I think we could benefit from is understanding, as part of the discussions we're going to go into, what's actually there and what's actually not there. What are we missing? The need for granular controls is increasing, but the ability to do so consistently across all the data holders, so that from a patient perspective, the data is consistently shared or not shared at where it should be according to the privacy and consent rules. There still are a fair number of gaps into what's needed before that can be fully done. So I think having that part of the conversation when we go through it, recognizing where the missing parts are, where the gaps are, how much can we achieve before they are filled, and what cannot be done until they are filled, would be very informative on providing recommendations on where to go with this, what's next to make this work.
Thank you. And I thought Pike had one, but Eliel, I guess we're at you.
Yeah, so I wanted to offer one a suggestion, I think, on the privacy and security that we may can have a bit more discussion on that. I think you all know about some of the situations of misuse of data for treatment within TAFCA. And I think that comes, relates a lot with a few things that we have here. And including what I was talking about in terms of, standardized logging. I think those cases there are going to probably take years in terms of how those, class action lawsuits are going to run. But I think, yes, that, ways to track down and log who is using it for what purposes, one thing that becomes quite important. So how to frame that specifically on the case of TAFCA or others, that might be a discussion point for us to extend when we have when we start talking about the specific topics. Steve, you have comments as well?
Yeah, I was just going to say the other piece of disclosing data is really looking at the potential for including accountability for those data disclosures so that patients understand to whom their data has been disclosed, for what purpose. And I think just put a kind of a human touch on it. I always like to point to myself as an example of re-identification. I am the only male in Texas above the age of 45 with my particular rare condition, which makes it really, really difficult to de-identify me. I'm perfectly happy in most circumstances to be identified, but it does provide a real-world example of, hey, identification really can be a challenging thing, or de-identification can really be a challenging thing that really can affect people's lives. And how do we manage it?
Yes. And I will add on yours before moving on to the next topic. One thing I see as looking at rural health research and the things we deal with in like North Dakota for de-identifying, it can be a challenge, especially in rural, very small populations. When you get in very rural areas and very, you know, it's certain things, it's very easy, even if you would de-identify, to be able to identify. So it is definitely something that needs to be considered, as well as the example you mentioned. So in the interest of time, I think we got about maybe 10 minutes before I give it back to Tara to wrap up. We'll go to the patient access information and get some feedback on that. The first topic on there is improving the use and sharing of patient-generated health data. Secondly, improving usability of health data. Third, improving price transparency and consumer-driven affordability. Fourth, to access information blocking and enforcement, or sorry, address. Shh. And finally, to improve access to clinical and device data. So open to comments on patient access to information from anyone. Anna?
Yes, one of the things that has become more and more of a concern for me as I get access to more and more of my data through different apps that are getting data through, like TEFCA, Care Quality, etc., is like the prevalence of errors. And sometimes they're not even errors. They're coding choices the clinician has made because it's easier to get something reimbursed if you put down a certain code. So I have seen diagnoses that I have never been given, but if I trace it back to like the physician that like gave that diagnosis, I've seen it in my data. And it's like, oh, that's interesting. But if I trace it back to the physician who actually made that diagnosis, quote unquote, or entered that ICD-10 code, I understand they were trying to get this particular imaging test covered. And it's a lot easier to do that if you gave me this particular ICD-10 code. So when we start thinking about, and like there are others that are more overt errors, I've heard so many different stories from patients. You know, one, like somebody, mother was not able to get transition into care because she was diagnosed with a case of MRSA, and it was an old thing, but the way that they could, something about her situation. So if they coded her as having MRSA, they were better able to get access to a particular treatment. I don't remember the specifics of it, but like it made it difficult for this person to be able to get access to her assisted living facility. And I've seen others that are funny where, you know, men are coded with like menopausal related symptoms, et cetera, because they needed, it helped them get access to something. So it can create serious issues. Sometimes it's humorous if it's a human doctor who's actually reading it and taking a look at it. But as we move towards the institution of clinical, of AI in the clinical setting, these types of errors in data or specifically chosen ICD-10 codes to justify treatment, you know, justify access to a particular treatment or diagnostic can cause real issues. So there needs to be some degree of standard of fidelity of data that for before it actually gets incorporated into some sort of an AI system. Otherwise, we're going to end up with more errors than we're preventing. And then secondly, I mean, one of the easiest ways to do that is to make it really easy for patients to access, review, and fix their data. And that, I mean, the processes that are currently in place don't work. I've done it with my providers. I never get any feedback. I never get any response to my request for an error correction. So that is one thing that is a significant issue that needs to be addressed. It's not taken seriously. I know it's not easy, but the reality is it's not just a human that's going to be reading this data. We're moving very quickly into a situation where this is all going to be read by a machine or an algorithm who won't be given the ability to make decisions or make recommendations that may not represent what's in the best interest of the patients. And then also one of the things that I've become more and more aware of or more and more sensitive to is the fact that I feel like ONC and HHS need to do much more investment in incorporating patient input into decisions, these kinds of decisions. That's not been something historically has been prioritized by ONC, by CMS, by other things. They make rules or RFIs available for anybody to be able to comment. But the reality is that most of those comments are done by industry, by people who are paid to pore over these extensive documents and to give their expert opinions. Patients, quote unquote, do not have time to do that. Some of us do it anyway as a volunteer, but we're not getting paid for the substantial amount of time and expertise it requires to be able to read it, understand it, and give input. So the idea that we're making it possible for patients to give input into regulatory decision making at any level, I would argue, but particularly when it comes to things like health IT and health technology, is absurd. It's window dressing. And as we get into more and more sensitive discussions around privacy, security, consent, AI, et cetera, there needs to be a much more concerted, deliberate, and thoughtful approach to getting patient input in a way that makes it accessible to enough patients that you can get a diversity of perspectives.
Thank you, Anna. Those are very helpful comments. And I agree with the AI comment because, as they've said, garbage in, garbage out. If the data isn't clean, we have wrong codes, it's going to snowball and lead to more and more issues as the more of that's incorporated. So that was a great comment to bring up. Elio.
Yeah, I agree as well. And if it's not complete data, that's another big issue, right? So we need to get all the data of one individual to be combined so that you can actually have intelligent AI use the whole complete data. That's where I had a point here is the last bullet we had on patient access of information. It says improve access to clinical and device data. My personal opinion that that could be expanded to improve access to health-related data of all types, not just clinical and device data. We could have social data. We can have other types of health-related data that affect someone's lives that I think would be important. And maybe we want to consider some reorder, which we don't need to discuss here today, of these topics, because I think prior access is the key first step. Then usability might be another one, which Anna touched on, and then we can, reorder them by priority and importance. So, Steve, I know we're running out of time quick. We still
Well, Elio, we're okay on time. I checked with them and they told me we're okay to keep discussing for a bit yet.
I'll also keep it short. I think another aspect of AI and patient use or patient access to data is including patients in the loop about both AI development and a utilization. As I mentioned earlier, I've got this really rare condition. One of my concerns personally is how is that information being incorporated into AI so that as we look to AI decision making about making recommendations about treatments, is AI including the diversity of health information that's out there to recognize conditions like what I have and lots of other ones, and accounting for that as it's making a recommendation about a care plan?
Thank you. I'm going to have Michael go real quick, Anna, since he hasn't talked about this one yet. Michael?
Shyla, my comment was actually in follow-up to a comment from Anna's, ironically, which
Okay,
is,
fair.
which is one of her comments was that stuff ends up in the medical record that's not exactly true, because it was selected, for example, in Anna's example, for billing rather than for medical care. And I do agree that that happens quite often. And I just wanted to make the comment that under interoperability, that one of the topics is improving data quality and standardization. And to me, that's where that really belongs. And having said that, well, I mean, put it this, I mean, in that bullet point to me in a way covers that topic. And where I'm going with that is that I think improving quality of data is really hard. And I'm not sure how we go about doing that. And if there are cases where we need additional research to figure out how to improve data quality, or for example, whether there are automatic ways to review and identify mistakes. And if NIH can play a role in doing some of that research, I just, if that's an avenue of collaboration, please sort of, I would love if that ends up somewhere in the report. So that's basically my comment.
Thank you. Anna?
I'll try to make this quickly because I've talked about it a lot in prior annual report work groups and quite a bit over the past 15 years. We have to be able to get sensor-based data into the EHR, particularly within the context of AI. I mean, whether the issue is data quality and accuracy, or deliberate miscoding to support reimbursement. That to me is terrifying when you think about incorporating that into an AI system and what might come out of it, particularly if I'm unconscious. But more I, there the idea of somebody making a decision that does not include my continuous glucose monitor or my CGM monitor data, or my insulin pump data. To me, if that isn't incorporated into some sort of automated decision-making process with AI, I don't have the slightest idea what might come up. Because like I've been in a situation like in the ER where I've been in diabetic ketoacidosis because of a device failure. I overheard the ER doc giving insulin dosing recommendations. Fortunately, I was still conscious enough at that point to be able to stop them and say, if you give that to me, it will either kill me, or it will put, because I'm super insulin sensitive, it'll either kill me or it's going to make my blood glucose drop so dangerously low that you're going to have to pull me out of a coma. And also, that could cause brain damage, cardiac arrest, et cetera, et cetera. So, if that data, which is freely available on my phone or in the cloud in any other way, could be incorporated into a decision-making matrix that, if those sorts of decisions are going to be automated, then it needs to have the most granular data available. And right now, the idea of just doing AI based off of basic, RCT-based clinical standards is terrifying because there is so much variability in the type 1 diabetes community. And that's just with the disease that I live with. I'm sure it's the case with lots of other things too. So it has to be prioritized again as we're moving more and more breathlessly toward incorporating AI into the clinical setting. So maybe not as brief as I thought.
It's fine. You're good. All the detail, because we do have The Excel team did tell me that they expect we do have time. We can discuss up to 4:25 if we need to. With that, we can go back if anybody has additional comments. Now that we've made it through everything, if anybody has additional comments that they've thought of some of the other ones, Hannah, I saw has a comment. You've arrived. Do you want to jump on and talk about that interoperability suggestion you have?
Yeah, thanks, Shyla. And I apologize for being late. But I am hearing just sort of across the industry right now concerns regarding trust in interoperability in the various frameworks in TEFCA, in care quality, and I think restoring that trust, restoring the T in TEFCA, as it were, right, is really important. And actors are not going to join these frameworks if they don't trust them. And so I would suggest a priority target area, not just, stating that we want to advance, right, these many areas of interoperability, but improving the overall public trust in interoperability, as I think that's an area that's a prerequisite for achieving the type of nationwide interoperability that we envision. So I'll just put that up for everyone else's sort of consideration as well.
So just if I can piggyback off of you, Hannah, is a lack of trust therein solely residing within the patient aspect, or is it in the provider aspect as well? And can you speak more about the distrust and what you're seeing and hearing? Because it may be in line with what I'm seeing on my side. I'm curious as to what that looks like for you, what you're hearing.
I think there's a lot of distrust on the provider side after some of the issues that have happened with Particle Health and others. And as the frameworks are scaling, right, as TEFCA is scaling quickly, I think there's a lot of concern that about whether this is being done thoughtfully, and providers trying to be advocates for their patients, and making sure that data is being exchanged
In a
thoughtfully
secure manner.
in a secure way, but also that actors are representing themselves appropriately or using the data appropriately. I'm not saying that everybody's a bad actor or that there are bad actors necessarily, but sometimes the actors are not necessarily. Or everybody's moving so fast that they are getting access to some data that they may not need access to or shouldn't have access to because everything is moving so quickly and scaling so quickly. And I think there is concern about that. And so, right, I mean, the TEFCA SOPs are coming fast and furiously. And so I think that is of concern. And right, we want to be providing patients access to their data. We want to be scaling. But I think there's concern when we see some of the issues that are happening about whether we're scaling in the right way. And, right, this is all contractual. So then what happens when the contract is broken, right? And who is adjudicating that? And, right, do they have the teeth to adjudicate that well? And, right, and so I think all of that is up for consideration, especially when then new actors are considering joining the framework as well.
Very good discussion. Hans.
Yeah, I would like to make some supporting comments that on the term scalable, that trust frequently is currently attained in one-on-one relationships. And what we're now trying to do, and what we have been working in a variety of different ways. This is not new. This any HIE that you start to connect with, the general term HIE, the more you start to scale, be a network, be part of it, you kind of build on the trust that you establish, what it can be used for, and with a more a larger mix of purpose of use, or actually the absence of purposes of use, where perhaps the parties may have generally a right to access, but not necessarily through the access purpose that that they would like to get it through, is not available yet. So what do you do? So I think the scalable aspect of the topic is critically important to look at it that way, and understand what is there, what can be further done to enhance that, so that we can rapidly work on that. There are certainly elements progressing in that space. Some of the SOPs being talked about would relate to vetting. How do you do that better? How do I establish that up front so that you can work with it? But it's then also the other side. What if that still is broken? How do you deal with that? So it's a very complex area. So yeah,
Yes.
if there are comments to be made, good topic, very specifically around the scalable part of it. What can make that work better that we can rely on that?
Before I go to Anna, I'm just going to jump on your comments that I agree, and especially as the health information exchanges are evolving into more the health data utility models, going from exchange of information, of utilize information, a lot of these topics with interoperability, privacy, and different things, are very important as we move forward. So, Anna.
Yeah, I just wanted to concur with the discussion and thank Hannah for raising it. It is a significant concern, and I do think that both you and what Hans emphasized is really part of the problem. I mean, so much of the I have not been involved in the governance of TEFCA at all. I have a little bit of insight into it as a member of the board of Sequoia, but like very limited. And I don't have time to sit in on all the monthly TEFCA meetings. So there are many things that are happening of which I'm not aware. But my sense is that so much of the effort around TEFCA was really focused on standing it up and getting it up and going and becoming a functional thing. And now we're at this natural point in development where it's like, okay, so it's operational. How is it working? What are the holes? What are the things that need to be fixed? What are the things that need to be addressed? And I feel like AST or ONC, sorry, just as soon as I get used to saying ASTP, they switch it back again. I think ONC really needs to focus in on contributing resources and devoting resources to making sure that there are processes to validate, the participation, also to ensure that data is actually being exchanged, that there aren't broad blocks placed by providers to stop data from going to any kind of third-party apps, because there are third-party apps that are using IAL2 and AAL2 and they're still not able to access data. That's ridiculous. Anyway, there needs to be some degree of enforcement in both of those directions, which is part of the whole let's make IAS real discussion that I brought up earlier. If providers have concerns about who is getting access to their patients' data, then we can talk about having real provider consents instead of just a legal CYA document. Coming up with ways and metrics of assessing how the data is being exchanged, what's being exchanged at what rate, who's not letting data go through, and then what's happening it after happening to it once it does go to these apps and tools and third-party technologies.
Thank you, Anna. A lot of great discussion. We do have still another 10 minutes or so. If anybody has any more thoughts on interoperability or anything on privacy and security or patient access to information, again, the Excel team and HITACH, they're going to take this back, update this. We will have another chance to validate it and discuss it also at the next meeting. So, any other thoughts or discussion?
Love to share a couple of thoughts there, Shyla. I really appreciate the comments around trust. because I believe that it's something that's hard to acquire, but when it's lost, it's even harder to recover from. And I think the example that comes to mind here is for human subjects in research, right? And I think if you are familiar with the Belmont Report, which is available at the HHS website, on how I think the background, the history here, the Tuskegee syphilis study that basically targeted individuals inappropriately, it was a terrible example of abuse of trust that then led to the creation of the report and the regulations that we have today to protect human subjects in research, right? So, but we still haven't recovered. Even though that report was written in 1979, we still have a very hard issue recruiting African American subjects in research because of that bad, loss of trust on the Tuskegee study. So all that to say that it's a good time for us to address trust and data sharing, because I think just like in research, we could see situations here that are very high abuse that then would be a much harder to recover from in the future. So thank you everyone for your comments on that front. And Steve, I think you had your hand up.
Yeah, I was just thinking about the mechanics of interoperability and ensuring that we're continuing to go to build a world where we're using things like USCDI and other frameworks so that we're looking at terms in common and sharing data that's both, semantic and functionally interoperable.
Yes, thank you for that. Okay. Well, if there isn't any other comments, I thank you all for the great discussion. You brought a lot up that definitely I know the team will take back to adjust and, as I said, for further discussion. So with that, I will hand it back to you, Tara.
Perfect. Thank you. Can we go to the next slide, please? While we're waiting, we will now be opening up the call for public comment. So if you are on Zoom and would like to make a comment, please use the hand raise function, which is located on the Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. And if you are on the phone only, you can press star 9 to raise your hand. And once called upon, you can press star 6 to mute or unmute your line.
Unmute your line.
Not seeing any raised hands. Estelle, do we have anybody on the phone only who would like to make a comment?
No comments at this time.
Okay, thank you. All right, if you could please go to the next slide. All right, just as next steps, just to refresh everybody on the work plan, as Shiloh mentioned, we do have one more meeting devoted to continuing discussion on this topic list and validating the list. And just going back to a question that we had early on about the number of topics to be discussed, just from a framing perspective, there is two meetings dedicated to each target priority area for a total of six meetings. So you can just consider that when framing discussion that once you identify those topics, you'll have two meetings to do a deep dive on each of those topics to come up with those gaps and opportunities for each of those. And with that, we look forward to seeing you all at our next meeting, which is currently scheduled for April 27th from 3 to 4:30 p.m. Thanks, everybody. We can adjourn.
Everybody.